Following is a letter from Alma, December 25th. Dear Fran, I've come to pay homage to Anne, Mary, and Magdalena, to Rachel, Naomi, and Ruth, to Miriam, who lives yet in two sentences of the Bible, for all the help she gave to Moses and Aaron. So much history, so much untold. How easily the mind slips back through countless years and unfoldings, but cannot guess tomorrow. We should have been filming here. Will Pavel and I ever be able to update Mother's pioneering movies? Or will this fall to Luna, perhaps all done virtually, no actors required, whatever? She'll have Mother's scripts, of course, and she may wish to tell other truths of our ancestors. I've begun a script in Nepal as I wait for Pavla to join me, the story of the first Karmapala Lama, who made a hat from the hair of several of our line. This black hat remains sacred to successive lamas, for they cannot claim full wisdom or authority without it. I'll leave my telling of this story with you when I visit next. I meet an enlightened ear tomorrow near Jerusalem, a new, apparently trustworthy contact, a risk but one I have to take, if there's ever to be peace in this region. To achieve peace worldwide, Mother died believing that we must surface and our truth be known, beginning with the publication of her biography. Your work putting all notes pertaining to her life onto microfilm is invaluable. I will deliver them soon to a potential biographer, a talented writer whom I hope will agree to the task. My prayers for Pavla's release are tempered by knowing that she is relatively safe in her present captivity. Following the publication of Mother's biography, in a year or two, I hope, this may be especially valuable. However long Pavla is kept from the world, in the longer term, a surmountable loss, as long as I can work and Luna is thriving, with great thanks to you. We are a thin line, one so nearly lost so many times, yet we continue. Alma put down her pen and rose to look out again at the procession, now wending its way toward the ancient cave, decreed to be the one Mary had used for the miraculous birth. Yet we continue, she repeated. She lifted her eyes to the vast dome of the sunset sky and prayed, please. Gray marked the limits of Pavla's new world, light, sparkly gray of native salt crystals in an abandoned mine. In enormous caverns, high-tech buildings comfortably housed a subterranean village of 1,000 souls. Greenery grew lush, providing habitat for carefully chosen amphibians, reptiles, birds, and small mammals. Myriad mined-out shafts, like airport corridors and shopping mall links, connected the cells of the site. The entire biosphere was complex and pleasing enough to keep bright people stimulated and happy, without end, in the care of this evolving experiment. Pavla had no complaints about the perfections of her jail and dared speak to no one about her captivity. She worked in a brilliantly equipped 20-by-20-foot laboratory. Three graduate students worked for her, each professional and idealistic. They had no inkling of her situation or relationship to outside collaborators. They had signed on, as eager volunteers, to a long-term experiment in creating a self-sustaining colony that might survive a global disaster or be replicated in a space station or on another planet. Pavla's research into enhanced immunity through mitochondrial factors fit well with the practical and high-minded goals of the project. Funding and direction came from international government agencies and multinational corporate interests. Top secrecy was necessary to maintain isolation and security. No one talked about their previous lives except superficially and in passing. None probed others' pasts as the rules dictated and common sense supported. The overall project precluded many degrees of freedom, but working as pioneer survivors and chosen ideal specimens primed to escape an increasingly unlivable Earth was the much-voiced, vaunted goal, worth many short and long-term sacrifices. Pavla lived in a small suite several levels up from her lab, accessible by elevators in an attractive web of walkways. She had decorated her private space with comfortable furniture and a few plants. It was relaxing but not homey, no pictures or mementos to remind her of other possibilities. Her bathroom jacuzzi swirled away the tensions of long hours of work and report writing, filling a schedule she alone planned and kept. She used computers on the biosphere network, tied to no others, anywhere. Every few evenings, Trigliani sent brief messages to her, querying her health and progress. They popped up as notes on the computer in her quarters, then vanished within a minute and could not be copied or retrieved. A blank note then popped up for her to reply if she chose. She answered tersely. She wrote down none of their correspondence. Leaving traces would be folly, obviously. Her biosphere companions communicated mostly in English, although many languages could be overheard. She quietly exercised some of her linguistic gifts, which explained, as much as any needed to know, why she was chosen from many possible contenders to join this gifted society. Holidays of all sorts sparked the passing of work-intense days and weeks. The HR department's recreation team managed them deftly to corral any religious intolerance or fervor, keeping work and play in healthy balance. Diurnal lighting mimicked 45 degrees north latitude. The increasing darkness of November and December had the expected sobering effect on the colony. At winter solstice, the need for light, fun, and celebration became palpable. It was Christmas and Hanukkah for some, Santa and gift time for all. Presents had to be simple and handmade. A bouquet of flowers from communal gardens, mugs from the pottery studio, various sorts of friendship bracelets, tasty bits made in shared kitchens, clever cards galore. Recreation directors made sure that everyone took part equally and fully, or bowed out as they wished, with counseling backup for those with underlying concerns or issues. As anticipated, psychological well-being of the Biosphere Project was as vital to maintain as its biological and technological systems. Pavla had arrived just months after its opening. At the first winter solstice festival, the community proved happily established with fewer wrinkles to iron out than expected. All sorts of contingency measures to catch social disturbances would stay in place, although it would take inordinate disruption by a majority of the colonists to upset the many checks and balances in place. Forecasts predicted more of the same, indefinitely. On the first New Year's Eve day, until late afternoon, Pavla worked in her lab. She then returned to her bedroom and changed from lab coat to a simple satin sheath and pearl choker. She clipped up her hair and slipped her feet into stylish heels. The evening's gala filled the central assembly hall, glowing with hundreds of candles and festive with shiny streamers. It promised to be a night of rare elegance with a banquet of gourmet pleasures. She sat at a round table set for eight, with six others already seated. Waiters poured tinkling iced water. Wine stewards popped champagne corks and served the expensive bubbly. As Pavla took her first sip, Dr. Dino Trigliani slipped into the empty seat beside her. She nearly choked. "May I?" he asked. "You look lovely." She caught her breath. "Why not?" He greeted the rest of the table, but was clearly intent on talking to Pavla. The others could chit-chat later with this elegant stranger. "Things are going well," he said. A statement, not a hint of question. "It's easy to make progress without distractions. Being brilliant helps," he smiled. "And an optimist, your attitude is admirable. There's no other to have." Trigliani looked at her, her eyes intent on hers. He said, his voice intimate, "You are most remarkable. I've had to defend my position regarding your fate, with some difficulty, which may or may not be of interest to you. But there is no doubt that I am making the right choice. Those who think otherwise do not know you." With a touch of warmth, she said, "Thank you." He leaned toward her to say quietly, "Is there a chance you could ever forgive me?" Equally quietly, she returned, "For saving my life after taking complete control of it?" Those who study this sort of situation say, "Yes, absolutely." Conspiratorially, she added, "I could, and probably should, fall in love with you." He laughed. "You frame it so nicely." He reached for a champagne. "May I drink to your success?" "Of course," she said, raising her glass to his. "There is no alternative." "Quite," he quickly concurred. "To success and more." They clinked and sipped. After the meal, Pavla danced several formal waltzes with Trigliani and joined other livelier dances with men and women from around the world. She moved with eye-catching skill and grace. Trigliani watched discreetly, his heart tightly under wraps, but on his sleeve nonetheless. She allowed him the last dance, a slow waltz at proper arm's length, although they were each aware of the other's warmth and scent. As it ended, he dared to ask, "May I see where you live?" "What? Is the surveillance not adequate for you?" "There are no cameras in private quarters, no bugs." "Then the experiment is seriously flawed. You must have them installed at once." He laughed, softly, then importuned, "Please, it is important." She stiffly conceded. They walked silently to her living quarters through a series of passageways filled with bright floral paintings and thriving plants. Others in small groups, enjoying an evening walk or returning home, talked and laughed. At Pavla's door, he said, "I would like to come in." Leaning close, he muttered, "Just 30 seconds, I promise." She hesitated, then opened the door for him. He slipped in. She followed. She left the door ajar and stood by it, ready to let him out as quickly as he had entered. From an inside jacket pocket, he retrieved a brown envelope, standard booklet size, and half an inch thick, and handed it to Pavla. Michelle had printed Lutile tie-in on it. Pavla recognized her hand. "More work?" Pavla said. "Charming." She dropped her voice. "And smuggled. I'm impressed." "Shh, open it." Pavla did. She retrieved a framed photograph of Luna sitting with Lord Byron, her small hand clutching a string of amber worry beads. Tears welled up immediately. She blinked them back, held the photo to her heart, then looked at it again. Trigliani said, "You may keep it, but discreetly, please, in a place that even cleaning staff won't look. Better safe." Pavla nodded. She sniffed, wiped her tears, and said happily, "She's obviously well, thank you." Then she asked, "Do you know who's looking after her?" While thinking, "That dog, those beads, I could find her in a minute." He quickly shook his head. "No, and I do not want to know. I cannot be forced to say what I really do not know. Our sponsors will not press as long as we make progress. I have bought us about 5 years, and if we do well, maybe 5 and 5 and 5 years more." Pavla sighed heavily, discouraged by his promise. "I'm not such a beast, you know. How can I prove it?" "You know the answer." "Only too well, but there are two ways of doing it, and I am working on both, believe me. The longer term has many advantages. The immediate is possible, but very risky. That is why I am here. I must leave." He glanced at his watch. "I am late already. Must rush. You may leave with me if you like." Pavla's eyes widened, as in, "Yes, I will take you to the nearest town and set you free, with money to go wherever you choose. I'm not clever enough to convince them for long that we are progressing without you, and they will be very angry when I say that our collaboration has ended. If I say that you have escaped, they will look for you everywhere. They will look for Luna and your mother too, which I now keep them from doing. If I say you have died, they will demand proof and your cryogenic location, and they will double their efforts to find Luna and your mother. I cannot stop them. Dreamers will dream you again, unless you and Luna hide forever in a cave like this, or Faraday variety. No life for a child, and no hope for dreamers, if that's important to you." "Of course," Pavla said. "How do you know about dreamers? Is that how you track me?" Trigliani leaned close. "I can tell you in here, the only safe place. Yes, a great aunt of mine was a dreamer from Sunoco's death. A nun, too, who spent much of her life in an insane asylum. She dared to tell me things. I rescued her notes just before she died. My mother was a very strict Roman Catholic. She despised the devil that got into her mother's little sister and feared it in herself. In me, I have been very devout. I am still in my own way. I cannot explain further, because we must leave immediately if you wish to go." Pavla swallowed hard, stunned by the offer and its dangers. Trigliani continued, "Of course, I will be at risk of interrogation should you leave before our research bears fruit and, I hope, wins us our freedom. Yes, our freedom. I am under close scrutiny with very little freedom, believe me. If you slip from us, I will be asked to confess everything I know, which is considerable, about you and your history. I try to imagine, in great detail, how I will bravely withstand torment and die without breaking. But I may not be the man for it. They are as sophisticated and as brutal as such work requires. That said, do we make a run for it? Or do you concede that our present arrangement is safe and functional?" Pavla struggled to answer, staring at the photo of Luna through eyes blurred with tears. Finally, she said, "There is no we, not as you might wish," and her voice cracked. "I cannot go. The risk is too great. Luna must live as freely as possible and thrive. She is everything." Trigliani's eyes looked pained. "Is it terrible of me to give you this choice?" She quickly shook her head. "No, I understand much better." She looked at Luna and smiled as best she could. "You've brought me this, a wonderful gift. Thank you. I must settle better, putting all thoughts of freedom, and certainly premature freedom, behind me. We have many years of work to do, and it satisfies me to explore the mysteries of life within. I'm prepared to finish my days here. "You are immensely wise for a young woman," he sighed in despair. "I am sorry, deeply sorry, that you must think this way, however necessary it is. When it is safe for me to come for you, I will do it, but the world has never been safe for my family, nor will I count on your rescue. In fact, I'm not counting on anything to do with days, months, and years, only scientific progress." Trigliani smiled broadly, ruefully. "We will do great things together. This non-we, not together. Now I must go." Pavla nodded. She kissed her fingertips and placed them on Trigliani's cheek. He closed his eyes gratefully and held her hand to his face. "When," she ventured to ask, "will you return?" He looked into her remarkable eyes and said quietly, firmly, "Never is a safe assumption. Good night." She opened the door for him. "Thank you," she whispered, then shut him out. She listened to his footsteps fade to nothing, thinking, "You could be a great man. One day, maybe. I've hope for you, if not for me, and that's something." Trigliani watched his feet, pushing one expensive shoe after the other down the labyrinthine walkways, thinking, "One step at a time, leaving, one step at a time, getting back. How? How will I return? God help me find a way." He pulled a rosary from his trousers pocket, and as he flicked the beads, mouthed, "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb." An email follows from Santu Singh to Larry Singer, date 30 December, subject, wheelchair bound, ungagged. "Larry, hey freedom boy, how's the great American first draft? On tap and running free, I hope. Some news just in, not festive but a relief. Young thug injured in an abduction attempt, says a woman broke his neck protecting her baby. Is babbling revenge, mention McMahon's name, one of his nurses reported it. Tattoos match the video, but he's shut up totally, no leads on the other guys. Is the woman the one they kept asking about in the video? No matter, he's in custody and the net's out for his buddies. Helps me sleep better, hope it does you too. Merry and cheers, etc. Santu." The bottom right of Larry's computer monitor read December 31st, 15:48 p.m. The big flat screen showed a document containing the words, "Telling News" by Larry Singer. They sat centered in a sea of white space. Larry hunched before the machine, silhouetted against a wide window, open to a thatched roof veranda and tropical ocean view. His chin rested on one hand, the other tapped the desktop. Beside it sat the memory stick labeled Rewind, One Life. Nearby, all 72 of his personal notebooks, standing upright in two neat rows, filled a small bookshelf. Nothing else cluttered the scene. Nothing intruded between man, means, and intended masterpiece. His eyes wandered from monitor to mouse to the little Rewind thumb drive, then drifted out the window. He gazed past the fringe of the eaves to nearby hibiscus shrubs with blood-red flowers. A meandering path through a grassy stretch by a few palm trees led to a pink sand strip of beach. Farther still, aquasurf rolled in tirelessly from the hard line where dark blue sea met pale blue sky. Through a Dutch door, both halves closed, Raoul appeared from the kitchen. He carried a frosted tumbler, an off-kilter cylinder with beaded lines of multicolored, hand-spun glass containing fresh tropical juices. He read the monitor. "Fabulous, darling, just 100,000 words to go." Larry took the proffered drink without looking up. He took a sip. Thank you. Maybe a million. I've got every possible story and angle input now. Look at this." He scrolled down the screen to the next page and the next, which contained a long list of headings and chapter ideas. "Enough for 10 books, can you believe it?" He held up the thumb drive. "The key is in here. My rosebud's in here. So hit Mr. Thatcher in the gut with it and get on with the show." Larry nodded. "Exactly. I'm going to swack 'em all. Every soul and Randy and Al in my life and the business, every one of them who, dear God, there are so many. But not get too personal, right? I mean, it's a novel. So I have to cut through the details and bullshit, get right to the truth, draw it up tight, concentrate the punch. The problem is narrowing it all down, hanging it on the right central character, the exact right hook." Raoul said, "The hook you need right now, I'd say, is called a sentence. You'll need a few of those, noun, verb, you know how they go." I need just one noun, one rosebud. Where the hell's my rosebud? What matters is what's missing, but what exactly is it?" "The whole freaking thing is missing," Raoul guffawed. "And supper will be too if I don't get on with it. Any suggestions, or should I just fry the oatmeal lumps from breakfast?" Larry muttered intently. It's in the peripherals, it's in the context that defines the core, which is deep in the key character. Of course, my God, Maya's words, exactly. Larry started typing quickly, missing. The truth versus reality, Saul versus Abel, ostensible versus surmise versus known, solidify, iconize. Supper, darling, Raoul said. If it's fish again, I've got to go check with down the road. Deep in thought, Larry said, yes, do that. It came in the mail, I think. Raoul threw up his arms. You poor lost loon. Excuse me while I go deep fry some dingbats and have our New Year's tofu turkey flown in from the funny farm. Raoul returned to the kitchen via the swinging doors that blocked the sounds of his life from the mutterings of Larry's. Caribbean jazz bounced from a speaker, filling this modern addition to an old cottage. Bright sun poured in through the open entry door, backlighting a woman wearing a broad straw hat and calf-length cotton dress. Raoul squinted to recognize her. Alma! He grabbed his heart and gasped. My God! Goddess! He fell to his knees, took her hand, and kissed it profusely, making her laugh. I'm sorry that I didn't warn you, she said. I hope you don't mind. Mind? I have no mind. I'm living with a madman. Seeing you is heaven. How is Larry? Healthy? Insane? Working like crazy? Getting nowhere? And he won't invite you to help him. Not until he's found his blessed rosebud among a list of story ideas a mile long. Oh, dear, I shouldn't have come without warning him, I guess, but I have a favor to ask, and I'm glad in a way that he stalled. I hope that I can kick-start him, either on his own writing or something else entirely. Kick away, darling, but listen, I've got a plan. Let him struggle and suffer until I drag him to the lanai for dinner, and there you'll be sitting gorgeous as a dream, and I'll have the nitro ready for his heart attack, if you don't mind waiting a couple of hours before seeing him. Do you think we should? Alma's eyes twinkled. Raoul laughed with glee. Splendid meal, Alma said to Raoul as he cleared the dining table of all but red grapes, local soft cheese, and three tulip whimsies of wine glasses. My pleasure, he said with a grin. A dash of this, a twist of that, and the best of company. Indeed, she said. Now, Larry, she fixed her eyes on his. You've been sketchy about your progress, and I've been vague about my purpose. It's time to tell you exactly why I'm here. I understand how important it is that you write your book. And you know that I'll help you with it, any way possible. Nonetheless, I'm going to dare to ask you if you would consider writing a different book for me first, while your own ideas percolate. Too many ideas, a million, and not the exact right one, the core peripheral, the exact heart of it, the missing piece. Alma smiled. And I've got a missing piece, all the peripherals, but not the exact right author, not yet. I'm hoping it will be you. Larry cocked his head. Before Mother died, she asked that her biography be written and published. I think you're the one to do it. Larry looked stunned. You're kidding, Raoul blurted. Aren't you in enough danger without telling the world? Alma shrugged. Given the state of this old world, Mother felt that the danger of not telling may be greater. Human impact on the planet has reached crisis levels. We have zealously and most successfully husbanded every resource while failing to wife and mother them in requisite balance. Maya and the rest of us have worked behind the scenes for eons to keep humanity thriving in the bigger picture. But our successes and technological wizardry are swamping us. We must come out and work overtly, or die along with life as we know it. On the positive side, we've never had such communication abilities, and let's hope, a global village ready for us. As for personal danger to our line, a lovely spin-off benefit of Pavla's captivity is that she's relatively safe. She also has the in vitro means to have another child, should Luna. Alma shook her head. No, let's focus on the positive. I promised Mother that I'd oversee the writing of her biography for publication, and that has brought me to your door. Would you do us that honor, Larry? Larry blinked, slow to find his tongue. Why me? Brilliant journalist, straight goods reporter, great with words, worldly view, finger on the pulse, time and means, met Mother and loved her, I assume. God, yes, he sputtered. So? Who else have you asked? No one. You're it, if I can tag you. Alma, Larry said, breathing deep for courage, then blinking back tears and swallowing a lump in his throat. I will do it. I will try. Alma grinned. Tears of joy, I hope. Larry grinned back. Wonderful, she exclaimed. I've got everything you'll need with me. Fran has put all the notes about Mother's life from birth to death onto microfilm. I brought a scanner to run the pages through a computer. A new one we'll get for you. Dedicated to this, strictly offline. I hope you can read them that way, and I'd rather they weren't printed out. No problem. The manuscript should be no more than 300 or 400 pages and 12-point type, double-spaced, the usual formatting. There'll be no photos of Mother, although some of her well-known contacts, certainly. She wanted a standard biography, a chronological overview of her life. Nothing fancy, nothing overstated. Just scary as hell and inspiring beyond. As he searched for words, he realized in a bright flash, Alma, she is Rosebud. You all are, my God. Forget telling news. I'll be telling Maya, won't I? Telling the world her tale, telling her at last that I hear her, that I'm paying attention and praying to her for wisdom and strength, telling her I love her. May I use that for the working title? Telling Maya? Alma thought for a moment, then smiled. It's perfect. May Singer Jones's house sat empty, half a year since she left it and nearly a century since her father built it. The art had been cursorily tidied, while the inside had undergone an eye-popping renewal. Fran had moved May's papers into carefully labeled boxes, and Nikos had organized them in the attic and basement. They cleaned her brass ornaments of their dusty, webbed sediments and donated them to a local charity that got good value for them. They changed May's time-heavy draperies to light, bright, vertical blinds and replaced May's living room furniture with Fran's. Only the upright piano remained, with the best love May photo sitting in her prime atop it, overseeing the transformation. Painters brightened every room with undercoats of off-white primer. The walls would stay that way until Nikos and Fran worked out the full color scheme. Their only decor was a large oil painting Nikos had chosen and hung on one living room wall, an abstraction of Mount Parnassus and the stone goddess and soldiers who haunt the Delphi Museum. Most of Fran's exotic, eclectic collections sat packed in boxes, stacked in a storage locker. There had been no time for such details when cleaning, refurbishing, and organizing took every minute. She welcomed the monastic look and feel in contrast to her and May's former lives. In the kitchen, a small calendar hung from a bulletin board. The December photograph featuring Larry's lush and turquoise view. Outside the window, skeletal shrubs scritched their wind-blown fingers against the glass. Maya's guest room still had the old bed she used when dropping in, plus a crib for Luna. Baby paraphernalia dotted every room and filled the house with sweet scent and purpose. All was still, however, eerily quiet. No one home. Apollo's taverna and Chryso throbbed with music and motion, color and feasting. Noisy cheer and rich cooking smells wafted from open windows to the heavens, which swirled with countless stars. Orion presided. The Big Dipper endlessly poured. On a small patch of open floor in front of the musicians, Nikos took the microphone and sang a love song, his pitch true and voice rich with feeling. As the tempo hastened, he switched to dancing. He flicked his head for Fran to join him. Fran skipped to him with Luna in her arms, and the three sashayed and kicked. Luna giggled with glee, her heart clearly as big as her whole tiny being. The aunt clapped her hands wildly from her seat in the crowd. A flashy young waiter hovered to serve her every whim. Spiro worked the bar where Retsina flowed freely for his dozens of guests. He watched like a godfather and grinned like a new millionaire. The aunt's waiter approached Spiro for another round of drinks on his tray, daring to shout for something special for the girl of his dreams. The lad won a rollicking laugh for his sentiments. The aunt's new Uncle Spiro shouted back, in English, in case she overheard, "She's too smart for you. Here, take her Coca-Cola and beg to be her slave. She needs Retsina," the boy pressed. "She needs a good talking to and the world to contain her." Spiro took the waiter's tray and leaned into his ear. "She needs to dance. Go, go." The aunt soon joined the crowd with her suitor, whose customers could fend for themselves. At midnight, Elena clanged old pots together, signaling an eruption of loud cheers for the new year. Luna jumped and cried with fright. Fran held her close, and Nikos encircled the two of them. Her wails turned to cranky fussing as she rubbed her eyes and whimpered, "Need bunny." The aunt hurried over to see what was wrong and said, "I'll take her to bed. I'll babysit." "Really, that would be great," Fran said. "You sure?" "Yeah," the aunt said, then flicked her head disdainfully in her suitor's direction. "Romeo's a bit much. He'd better not follow." Fran laughed. "Don't worry, we're coming with you, and if he dares lurk behind us, I'll scare him off." The aunt said, "Ooh, none better than you." "Come on, let's get her settled," Fran said, heading for the exit door. Nikos followed. The nippy air outside revived Luna, who giggled to Nikos an ipsuteras, or elevator. He slowly lifted her over his head, making a machine sound. With a ding at the top, he set her on his shoulders. She patted his head in delight. The four of them walked over cobbled, narrow streets, winding up the hill to Nikos's little apartment. Baby things burgeoned through his small place, including a travel cot for Luna in the small bedroom. Eschewing that, Fran settled her into the double bed where her great-grandmother had spent her last night. The Anne brought her shabby stuffed rabbit to Luna. The happy babe hugged it close, holding an old ear to her cheek, as Big Sister had done. The Anne quickly got into her pajamas and slipped in beside Luna. "This is fun," she said to Fran, "but where will you sleep?" "In your bed, at Spiro's. Don't worry," the Anne laughed. "Good luck, it's half this size," Nikos said. "You will leave the monitor on, yes, all night? We need to know that you are safe." Fran kissed both her girls. "Good night, my angels." The Anne stroked Luna's hair with her fingertips. She sang softly, "Lullaby and good night, close your little eyes tight." Fran smiled as she turned out the light and pulled the bedroom door almost shut. In the bright kitchen, Nikos whispered to her, "Is it safe enough, do you think? I could stay here." "They'll be fine," Fran whispered back. "I trust the Anne and, well, we're getting by on faith every day, aren't we? And doing rather well." She tapped a nearby bulletin board, holding their flight itinerary, crude alphabet figures by Luna, and snapshots from an instant film camera. Happy, safe days at the ancient center of the world. The bulletin board also held a letter-sized newspaper, the masthead of which read, "The New Nature Rag, editor The Anne Roma," followed by a heading declaring, "Virgin Bride Redux by Gypsy Rules." Fran chortled quietly. "She's a tiger. Luna's in good hands." Nico shook his head, eyes amused. "Poor Cindy, if she ever sees this." "Shh, don't even say it," Fran put forefinger to lips. "Or goodbye prep school. Great contextualizing, though. Gotta show Larry and Santu." In one of the snapshots, Luna stood alone by the outdoor Amphalos at Delphi, a vibrant toddler against great Parnassus and the great dark patch that shattered off when her ancient twin died. Fran flipped off the kitchen light, leaving only a nightlight's glow from the tiny bedroom. She and Nikos left the apartment and locked the door securely behind them. Arm in arm, they navigated back to the taverna by the infinite wonder of the stars. The end.